Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're cracking open an executive playbook for something that's really jumped up the risk register lately: workforce instability.
Yeah, it's definitely moved beyond just HR.
Absolutely. We aren't just talking about, you know, a single strike here and there anymore. This is chronic absenteeism, sudden talent shortages, persistent disputes, things that really threaten the core of how a business runs.
That's exactly right. And look, for organizations that really depend on hands-on labor or specialized tech skills or even compliance teams, this risk, it's almost existential now.
And there's data to back this up, right? It's not just a feeling.
Oh, definitely not. If you needed proof this is systemic, just look at the numbers. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, their 2024 report, showed the U.S. lost over 4 million workdays just from labor disputes alone.
4 million? Wow.
And it's not a blip. It's a rising trend structurally. You combine that with, say, post-pandemic absenteeism, economic pressures, workers being more vocal, the risk to just keeping the lights on operationally. It's undeniable.
So our mission for you today is to really dig into a structured, proactive playbook, something specifically for these labor disruptions, because let's be honest, those generic business continuity plans,
the ones gathering dust.
Exactly. They mostly focus on fires or IT outages. This is different. It's about protecting your actual day-to-day operations, maintaining compliance, and maybe most importantly, safeguarding your reputation.
Precisely. A labor continuity plan needs to be, well, a living document. It's a strategy that outlines exactly how your business keeps critical operations running when your people, well, when they're not available or there are fewer of them.
So it's laser focused on people.
Absolutely. Who does what, when they do it, and crucially, where do we find backup? Redundancy in staffing, not just servers. It's the playbook for when your main workforce engine is sputtering.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit more. Why does the C-suite, the board, need to see this as a strategic systemic risk now? Why isn't it just, you know, an HR issue to solve with a few temp hires?
Because the damage goes way beyond just labor costs. The ripple effects are just profound.
Okay, like what?
Well, start with a direct economic hit. The sources we looked at highlight that in sectors really needing physical or specialist labor, think manufacturing, big logistics operations, infrastructure maintenance, even a small, say, 10% dip in available staff, that can slow output by a huge 20, even 30%.
It's not linear at all.
No, it's exponential. And for service providers, it's immediate revenue loss. Shortened hours, closed locations, not enough people to face customers. It hits the bottom line instantly.
And the reputation hit.
Yeah.
That can happen overnight, can it? Long before you even fix the operational side.
Oh, instantly. If you're running, say, a clinic and wait times explode or a store with empty shelves, customers notice right away. And in this age of instant online reviews, social media.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
A staffing failure can seriously damage your brand image almost overnight.
But you mentioned something earlier that really caught my attention.
Mm-hmm.
The regulatory side. That's where it gets really sticky for executives, right? Like,
exactly. This is where it gets really interesting and, frankly, scary for the C-suite. Failure here isn't just lost revenue. It can literally threaten your license to operate.
Okay. Give us an example.
Take hospitals. They have very strict state and federal rules about staffing ratios, nurse-to-patient ratios, for instance. If a big labor disruption hits a strike, mass sick out, and those ratios drop below the legal minimum,
then what?
You're looking at serious fines, potentially putting the hospital's license in jeopardy. It's not just a slap on the wrist.
That's a massive liability.
Huge. Or think about transportation, trucking, airlines, rail. They operate under tight federal safety rules, like hours of service for drivers or pilots.
Right.
A strike doesn't suspend those rules. You still have to comply, even with fewer people. You can't just say, oh, well, we're short-staffed, so we'll ignore safety regs. Doesn't work.
And financial services?
Critical. Think about SEC reporting deadlines, JAP compliance. Those things are mandatory. A strike among your back office finance team doesn't mean the government gives you an extension. You must have those compliance teams operational.
Wow. Okay, that completely changes the game. It moves it from an efficiency problem to, like you said, an existential legal compliance issue.
Precisely.
And there are broader workforce trends making this more urgent too. You mentioned the strike activity jump 50% increase from 2022 to 2024. What about things like the gig economy? Did that backfire?
Well, it's complex. That flexibility came with some hidden risks. Many companies, especially in tech and delivery, leaned really hard on contractors.
Sure, for flexibility.
Right. But now you've got increasing legal challenges around worker classification. Are they really contractors or should they be employees if courts or regulators force reclassification?
And suddenly they're employees.
Exactly. Thousands of workers might suddenly become employees overnight, gaining rights to unionize, benefits, things the company probably hasn't planned or budgeted for in their continuity strategy. It's a huge potential vulnerability.
And generational shifts. Younger workers, these seem to have different priorities.
They absolutely do. There's a much stronger emphasis on work-life balance, less tolerance for, just grinding people down with excessive hours.
So the old playbook of just make everyone else work mandatory 16-hour days.
That's far less effective now. You might plug the gap today, but you're basically just trading that disruption for massive turnover 6 months down the line. You burn out the people who actually stayed.
Right, so the plan has to be smarter. It can't just be about brute force.
Exactly. It needs finesse.
Okay, so we need this smarter, practical template. The executive playbook you mentioned starts with risk assessment and workforce mapping. What are the key things to get right in this first phase?
This first step, the risk assessment, it's absolutely foundational. It has to go way beyond just counting heads. The sources are really clear on this. If you don't do this properly, your planning is just guesswork.
So what does properly look like?
It means first identifying and then prioritizing your critical functions, and not just based on revenue. You have to rank them by their impact on safety, on compliance, on legal obligations.
And you have to be realistic about what's truly critical, right? Not just important.
That's the crucial distinction. The temptation is always there to label everything as critical.
Which makes the plan useless.
Precisely. If everything's priority one, then nothing is. A good assessment forces leadership to make tough calls. Which functions, maybe dispensing critical meds and pharma or keeping the main security firewall up, are absolutely non-negotiable, and which tasks, like, say, updating the company blog, could realistically be paused for 60 days if needed.
Makes sense. And once you know the function, you need to know who does it.
That's the mapping part. You chart out the essential roles needed for those critical functions. And this is where you find those really scary single points of failure, SPOFs.
SPOFs. Okay, like who? Not necessarily a CEO.
Often not. A classic SPOF might be the one database admin who really understands that ancient but essential payroll system, or the only technician certified to operate that key piece of machinery on the factory floor.
Right, the person whose absence grinds everything to a halt, regardless of how many other people you have.
Exactly. If that one person walks out or is unavailable, that whole critical function might stop dead no matter what.
How deep did this mapping go? Do you need to look outside the company too?
Oh, absolutely. The plan has to have an external view. Leaders need to watch regional labor market data where are skills shortages popping up, and you absolutely must understand your existing union contracts.
Like expiration dates.
Expiration dates, yes, but also things like mandatory cooling off periods, the rules around using temporary staff during a dispute. Knowing your contractual obligations is key to avoiding legal traps when a disruption hits.
Okay, mapping dependencies sounds intense. But once you know who and what is critical, the next big question is obvious. Where do you find replacements or backups? Which brings us to step two, staffing alternatives and partnerships.
Right. This is all about building that redundancy, and you need both internal and external strategies here.
Let's start internal. What works best?
Internally, probably the most crucial and often most cost-effective long-term measure is cross-training, getting staff skilled in multiple critical functions.
So if your main operator's out, someone else can step in.
Exactly. It prevents that SPOF from paralyzing a whole function.
Cross-training sounds great, but here's the challenge I always hear. How do you get already busy employees to take on more? Isn't it often seen as just extra work with no extra pay?
That's the strategic hurdle, absolutely. And if it's just treated as an afterthought, like, oh, hey, can you learn Bob's job too? It fails. The playbook really emphasizes this. Successful cross-training has to be linked to tangible benefits. That could be compensation bonuses, maybe a higher pay grade, or clear career development paths. You have to reward people for gaining those extra skills.
Otherwise, you're just building resentment.
Exactly. Which, ironically, might just make future labor issues more likely. Also, internally, you need pre-approved overtime protocols, specific, well-defined rules for short-term gaps so managers have immediate tools. But, and this is critical, with strict caps to prevent that burnout we talked about.
Okay, that covers internal. But for bigger, longer disruptions, like a major strike, you have to look outside.
Correct. That's where external partnerships come in. You absolutely must have pre-negotiated contracts with temporary staffing agencies before a crisis.
Not scrambling when it hits.
No way. If you wait until the disruption starts, you're competing with everyone else who's suddenly desperate, and you'll pay exorbitant rates, assuming you can even find people. These pre-negotiated contracts need to lock down rates, the specific skills you need, liability coverage, how quickly they can mobilize, all the details.
What else externally?
You also need backup plans for any work you already outsource, so relationships with secondary subcontractors, and, increasingly important, identifying tasks that could even temporarily be handled by automation. Maybe tech you already have but don't use for core processes normally.
Okay, so you've done the assessment, you've got backup plans. Then the disruption actually hits. Communication becomes everything at that point, right? To stop things spiraling.
Absolutely critical. Step three is communication and stakeholder management. And the key word here is transparency, but it needs to be controlled transparency.
What does that mean in practice?
It means clear, honest messaging to your employees about what's happening and what steps are being taken. It means proactive outreach to your customers, adjusting delivery times, service levels before they complain. Never let the customer discover the failure first.
And the regulators.
Timely regulatory reporting is non-negotiable if compliance is impacted in any way. You have to inform them according to the rules.
Let's take that compliance example again. Say a strike takes out half your compliance team. How realistic is it to think you can still meet a critical deadline? What's the real plan B there?
The continuity plan must outline clear delegation pathways. If the primary compliance lead is out, the plan identifies who the pre-trained, maybe cross-functional backup is. That person immediately takes responsibility for those filings.
So it's pre-assigned.
Has to be. The risk of failure isn't just a missed deadline. It's serious reputational damage and potential legal sanctions. That's why the tactical communication checklist is so vital.
Okay, walk us through that checklist. It's not just what you say, but how you get the message out.
Right.
Exactly. The checklist demands precision. First, you assign specific spokespersons in advance. People trained to handle high-pressure media questions. Who can stay calm?
Got it.
Second, you prepare pre-drafted templates for different scenarios. A quick update on a minor shortage looks very different from a full strike announcement. Having these ready saves critical time.
And how do you deliver the messages?
Multi-channel delivery is key. Email, text alerts, updates on customer portals, maybe even physical signs at locations. You can't rely on just one channel, especially if your internal IT or email teams might also be affected by the disruption.
Okay, so communication is set up, but what if the temps and the cross-trained folks, what if it's still not enough? That leads to step four, operational adjustments. How do leaders cut back without failing on compliance or totally alienating customers?
Right. Operational adjustments are about managing with the capacity you do have. The playbook gives criteria for prioritizing. For instance, you might temporarily shorten service hours across the board.
Why do that instead of trying to stay fully open?
Because it allows you to consolidate your available staff and provide consistent, albeit reduced, service during those open hours. It's often better than having erratic, unpredictable full-day failures.
Makes sense. But what about prioritizing? If you have multiple clients, who gets served first? That sounds like a recipe for conflict.
It absolutely requires predefined criteria, yeah, agreed upon by leadership before the crisis. You have to prioritize critical contracts, maybe those vital for long-term revenue, or those with severe legal penalties for non-performance.
Like medical supplies over consumer goods.
Exactly. For a logistics firm, maybe critical medical deliveries take precedence over, say, non-urgent retail shipments. That triage hierarchy has to be decided in advance. You also need to adjust your supply chain proactively, maybe work with suppliers to slow down or stagger deliveries, rather than just accepting goods you can't possibly process. That just creates another bottleneck.
Okay, let's fast forward. You've managed the disruption, maybe survived it is a better word.
Yeah.
What does recovery step five look like? Getting back to normal seems like it could be just as hard.
Recovery is huge, and it focuses a lot on stabilizing operations, but also on the human element. First, there's the operational catch-up, dealing with backlogs.
Right. Everyone works overtime.
Well, carefully. You have to use staggered overtime, maybe flexible scheduling. The absolute worst thing you can do is force everyone who just went through hell or came back from a strike immediately into 16-hour days.
You'll lose them all over again.
You risk losing the loyal folks who stayed and the ones who just returned. Burnout is a massive risk post-disruption.
What about the damage done to the brand or to morale internally?
That needs deliberate, focused effort. Reputation rebuilding isn't automatic. It might involve specific outreach campaigns, being really transparent about any service issues that occurred, and explaining how you're moving forward. That builds trust back.
And internally, with the employees.
Employee relations is crucial. You need to actively rebuild morale. That means things like town halls, structured listening sessions. People need to feel heard, especially after maybe crossing a picket line or working under immense pressure. The plan actually needs to budget for these kinds of morale-boosting efforts.
This all sounds comprehensive, but it raises the big question. How do you know any of this will actually work under pressure? A plan and a binder is nice, but...
But it's useless if it hasn't been tested. That's step six. Scenario planning and stress testing, it is absolutely non-negotiable.
And you need to test different scenarios.
Definitely. No two disruptions are the same. You need to test for different durations, different levels of severity. Think about common scenarios. Maybe a short, sharp absenteeism spike 20% of staff out for a week. Or the really tough one, a full union strike lasting, say, 30, 60, 90 days, maybe hitting multiple locations. Or for healthcare, what if staffing ratios drop below minimums? How does the plan react?
The sources mentioned two main ways to test, tabletops versus simulations. What's the difference for the leadership team involved?
Okay, so a tabletop exercise is basically a structured walkthrough for leadership. Everyone sits around a table, you present a scenario from the plan, and you talk through it. Okay, this just happened. According to the plan, what's your first call? Who sends the emergency communication? It tests the decision-making process, the communication flow. Do people know their roles?
Right, it's a discussion.
Exactly. A simulation, though, is much more hands-on, much more intensive. This is where your IT team or HR or ops might actually run a mock disruption.
Like turning something off.
Potentially, yes, in a controlled way. Maybe they temporarily disable access to the main scheduling system for a few hours, or they might simulate a key machine being offline, or report that certain critical roles are unavailable for a shift in the system.
Whoa, so you might actually simulate the scheduling system being down for a bit, just to see if the manual backups and communication plans actually kick in. That sounds risky, but I guess necessary.
It's about failing safely, intentionally, in a controlled environment. Did the backup procedure actually work? Did the emergency contact list function? Did the manager who was cross-trained actually remember how to do the manual override? A simulation tests the execution and reveals system gaps a simple discussion might miss.
Okay, got it. And the final step, step seven, measuring preparedness and keeping the plan alive. This feels like where you prove the value, the ROI.
Absolutely. You need metrics that speak the language of the C-suite, metrics that justify the ongoing investment in this planning. Key things include response time, how fast was the plan activated, downtime duration, how long were critical functions impacted.
But the big one must be money, right?
The most powerful metric, often, is quantifying financial losses avoided.
How on earth do you measure something that didn't happen? That sounds tricky.
It is, but you can estimate it. You calculate the actual losses you did sustain during the disruption, maybe the cost of temps, the value of lost output. Then you compare that to what the projected losses likely would have been if you'd only had a generic plan or no specific labor continuity plan at all.
Ah, I see. So you're showing the difference the specific plan made.
Exactly. It reframes the continuity plan. It's not just an HR cost center. It's an operational insurance policy with a demonstrable payout.
That's powerful.
And showing executives, look, this plan costs $200K to develop and test, but it saved us an estimated $5 million in lost revenue during that last disruption. That's how you get the budget and commitment for the continuous improvement loop.
Which is?
Test the plan, record what worked and what broke.
Well,
update the plan based on those findings, retrain the teams on the updated plan. It has to keep evolving because the labor landscape and your own vulnerabilities are always changing.
So wrapping this up, what does this all mean for you, the listener? It means this kind of structured labor continuity plan isn't just about reacting to bad news. It's about turning uncertainty into a managed risk. It does that by pulling together HR, ops, finance, legal, compliance into one unified playbook. It makes resilience a concrete operational goal.
Yeah, the essential things here are that cross-functional buy-in and a real commitment to testing it. So our advice for leaders listening to this, don't wait for the crisis to hit.
Start now.
Get those teams together now. Identify maybe your top three scariest single points of failure. Run a realistic tabletop exercise focused on just one of those. And then commit, really commit to reviewing and updating that plan regularly, maybe quarterly. It absolutely cannot be a static document you write once and forget.
And the final thought for you to take away, businesses that really get ahead of this, that embrace proactive labor continuity planning today, they gain a massive competitive edge. It's the ability to keep operating, stay compliant, and maintain trust when their competitors, the ones who weren't prepared, inevitably stumble. It really is the ultimate test of resilience in today's volatile labor market. And thanks, Executive Foresight.
Absolutely.
So if you take one thing away, maybe start mapping those single points of failure tomorrow morning.